So my name's Katie and I'm 50 years of age, and I decided to embark upon this therapeutic journey because I'd reached a point in my life where I have overcome a lot of my demons. I've stripped away various layers of the so-called onion. I've revealed the sort of core problem, which is my anxieties and my struggles, my reactions to things in life, my emotions, and I want to explore the root cause of some of that. At the end of 2019, I knew, I felt this year was going to be huge, was going to be transformative in my life, and that's not with any knowledge whatsoever of what was going to happen in terms of the pandemic. So it all started in January when my dog died, my companion who I'd had, who was my best buddy. And then I had already decided at that point that I wanted to end my marriage. So I had put the wheels in motion on that. I knew obviously that I was going to be turning 50, and I knew that that was going to be a pivotal time in my life. And then 2 weeks after that, we went into lockdown. And then during lockdown, my son got into his boarding school. My older daughter was obviously going to go off to university, and that was still the plan. But then my second daughter decided not to take a gap year, that she would go this year as well. And then my other son got selected for an educational program that was going to take him away from school. So it ended up with, in September, that my husband left and all four kids left as well. I think I've never really found my purpose. And I think the nearest I've ever come to finding a purpose is being a mum. And I've loved that. I've loved being a mum. I think because I've tried so hard for so many years to try and just, you know, find whatever it is I'm looking for, and I don't even half the time even know what I'm looking for, is I'm tired, I'm exhausted, and I think my hope and my belief that this will do any good is weak. I've got some hope. I couldn't do this if I didn't have any hope. But I don't necessarily believe that it will work. And if it does, it'll just be temporary and I'll be back in the same situation again. Misunderstood and not really fitting into this world.
Well, Katie, welcome. I'm really happy that you're here. I've heard a few little bits and pieces from Oliver and Rachel, but I think a great starting point is I'd love to hear from you why you're here, what you hope to get from the time that we have together.
Yeah, so I suppose, lived with acute anxiety and depression all my life. And at various times in my life, it has significantly affected me and debilitated me, actually, at times, starting from my teens when it sort of first manifested itself, and then at various points at university, it really that's where I really sort of reached a very low point. And then on having had my first baby, it was triggered again. And then various points in my life which have been traumatic or stressful. I think because I'm a child, well, I was born in the 70s, and I think during the 80s when it all sort of started to come up, there wasn't really, you know, a focus on mental health wasn't there. It was something that was viewed as, I mean, the stigma that we talk about now. You know, I wanted to shout and scream from the rooftops, and everybody else wanted to brush it under the carpet. That was how it was. So my first visit to a psychiatrist was our next door neighbour, and it never went on my records.
And it was a psychiatrist, not a...
A child psychiatrist, right. Yeah. He was our next door neighbour. Right. So, and that was to deal with... I had terrible health anxiety, and I thought I was dying all the time. And it was crippling, because it was like living with a death sentence. I've always been the kind of person who wants to fully understand things. And I think growing up, I'd said to my father on many, many, many occasions, you know, what if I've got leukemia? And he'd say, well, there's a 99.9% chance that you haven't. And I would automatically think, well, what about the 0.1% that I have? And how do you know? And how can you tell? And
so you had. So it sounds like you had a big strategy of trying to think your way to a feeling of calmness, or trying to think your way to a feeling of safety. Like, if I can rationalize it enough in my mind, then I'll feel safe.
And I never could.
Right. But also I'm interested at this point, it sounds like the primary issue was anxiety. You mentioned anxiety and depression.
Yeah.
Where was the depression a result of the severity of the anxiety?
At that point, it wasn't really depression at all. That's come later.
Right.
So it was more anxiety. You know, I can remember from when I was 7 or 8 feeling that dread and that anxiety. And my first sort of coping mechanism, as I now understand it, to be attention seeking, you know, to try and get, or my first cry for help was to be naughty at school.
Right.
And I was really naughty.
In what way?
That I would, it was always, humour's always been very important in my life, and I was always a clown. You know, I just would, I was always very vocal. I always had, again, this is another thing that's a theme that's run through my life, is I've always had a very, very strong sense of injustice. And obviously a classroom is, you know, a breeding ground for injustice.
Yeah, sure.
And so I would call it out, and I couldn't understand why, as well as, you know, the other things like, you know, falling off my chair and pretending to break my arm and stupid things, you know. But I think it started, the bad behaviour started when I didn't feel heard.
Yeah, it sounds like you wanted to be heard and seen. Like there was something around your emotional needs as a child not being seen, not being heard. And ultimately the consequence of that, it sounds like you didn't feel emotionally held and emotionally safe. And so the way that you dealt with that was by going to your mind to escape your feelings.
Yeah.
So it was like, I have all these things that are happening in my body, my emotions, my feelings. They don't feel safe. They don't feel held. So I've got to go up here. And so you increasingly learn a strategy of disconnecting emotionally. The problem is that's a perfect recipe for anxiety, because the part of the resolution to anxiety is coming into the body and feeling the safety that's there inside of ourselves. But when we try to think our way there, we get further and further away from it, and we get more anxious than we try and think, and it becomes a sort of self-perpetuating cycle.
Yeah, and that's exactly what happened.
So understanding things that happened as a child is important to a point, but it won't actually, it's not going to change anything. What's going to change things is changing how you relate to yourself in terms of your emotions and your thoughts and your life. How you relate to yourself now, that's the piece that really is what matters to us.
Yeah.
Talk to me a bit more about just how sort of, life sort of evolved then from your 20s into 30s, and just sort of the key sort of beats and moments, particularly in terms of your mental health.
From the age of 18, really, I kind of began to lead a double life. So it was this, trying to deal with this anxiety and this mental health problem on my own, essentially, and then pursuing what was expected of me.
So what were you doing in terms of sort of vocation and that sort of thing?
Yeah, so it was, when I decided that I didn't want, I begged my parents to send me to RADA because I wanted to be on the stage, and they wouldn't because that wasn't academic enough. So so I think at some point I decided, I was very good at English, and I decided I'd do journalism. And I think that as well was linked to this whole, you know, people will it'll give me a voice, people will recognize me. I wanted to be a famous foreign correspondent. Fame was a big thing for me.
Right.
I wanted fame.
Because your value as a human being was tied to your achievements.
Yeah, and I wanted people to know, it felt like it would, if I was recognized, then I'd have achieved something, you know. It wasn't enough to be a journalist. I had to be the best journalist. Yeah. I had to work for the best company. I had to work, you know. So I'd set up a load of this is a strange event in my life, because I'd set up a load of work experience with the Times and the Guardian and the BBC and the Leicester Mercury, which is where my parents were living at the time in Leicester. Mm. And I did a week there, and at the end of the week they offered me a full-time job. And I accepted it, and I've often thought that was a really strange thing for me to do, because I had all this other work experience set up, you know, at these great places.
British institutions.
Yeah, and I don't know why I accepted that job to this day, but it's where I met my husband and ended up, you know, that
side. Life has its interesting twists and turns, isn't it?
Yeah, and I was there for 3 years, and I did very well there. I got promoted quite quickly. I won a couple of awards, and then within 3 years I was at the BBC. But I wanted, and that was what drove me, because I knew that I was flawed, so flawed, and I didn't want anybody to know about it. So I basically drank and worked my way through my 20s to try and just not deal with this anxiety.
To numb to how you were feeling, yeah.
And then I had a baby very quickly after that. I found out I was pregnant, and I got the job at the BBC in the same week.
Wow.
And my husband said, "There's no way we can go to London now." And I said, "Watch me." Again, I just was that. So I went. He wouldn't come. We'd been married for 3 months. And he never in a million years thought I'd just go. And I did.
And you were pregnant as well.
I was pregnant. Wow. And I came down and I rented myself a little flat, and I'd go back at weekends. And that's where our problems really began, I think.
And then what happened when the baby came?
So in those days, you only got 3 months off work when you had a baby. So, and I didn't want to have more than that anyway. I was so driven with my career. But I ended up having a lot more than that off because of I ended up crashing again because my anxiety just came back with a vengeance. And then my parents then offered to pay for me to have another thing of CBT, and I went to see somebody privately. And that's where I really picked up some tools, where we went through, you know, the sort of breaking the cycle and getting out of that and go, you know, what if the worst happens, and facing that, and if it does, how would you deal with it? And I remember then, and I had, you know, notes which I referred back to. But the anxiety wasn't about me at that point. It was about my daughter.
Okay.
That was interesting because it completely shifted. Mm. So she hit the back of her head on a shelf, and, you know, I was convinced that she had a brain hemorrhage, and she had a little spot, and it was a meningitis, and a tiny cough, and she was, you know, she had whooping cough.
And so just to sort of complete the sort of narrative sort of to now, so the anxiety became more fixated towards your daughter, but was still sort of impacting, but not as... but you have more tools, let's say. Just sort of catch
and
me
then
up
I
to
had,
sort of...
So then I had 4 babies in very quick succession. So I had 4 in 5 years.
Wow.
And I know.
That's something. That really is something.
I've paid the price, I can tell you. And but one of the reasons I did that, which is quite difficult to say as well, is because I felt so amazing when I was pregnant.
In what way?
I just felt this sort of a peace and a serenity and a happiness that I'd never experienced before. I had wonderful pregnancies. I think, and that's why I've always wondered in my life whether it's hormonal, you know, this whole thing that goes on with me, because the pregnancies were just amazing. And I loved having little babies around me, and I loved being needed and being,
you know. A sense of purpose.
Yeah, real sense of purpose. And that's what I've lost.
So it sounds to me like the depression has been a consequence of the hopelessness of not knowing what else to deal with the anxiety. So as opposed to being its own unique issue in of itself, it sounds like it's more been a consequence of what's gone on with the anxiety.
I'm very depressed now. You know, I'm very, very depressed at the moment. And it's because I just loathe myself. I look back and think, what a life, you know. What a life, what a disaster, what a failure, I've lost everything, you know, that's what I feel like at the moment. People's view of me is very different from my view of me, and people's idea of me from how I present to the world is very different to how I feel inside. Although I've had moments of happiness in my life, like when my kids were born, and on the day I got married, for example, you know, that were those moments, those glimpses of happiness. I fundamentally haven't had peace of mind or happiness as an ongoing, consistent state of mind ever. And I've always, you know, my whole life has been underpinned, I suppose, by this anxiety and this fear and this sadness. I suppose I always wanted to give to my kids what I never had for myself. I always wanted them to feel that they were unconditionally loved, that they were safe and secure, and that I would protect them, come what may. And I think they did feel that. I think they do feel that. But sometimes I've gone over the top in that. You know, I've fought battles that maybe weren't battles to be fought, and a lot of that was probably on behalf of the sort of hurt little girl that's inside of me that never sort of had that support as a child. I think having stripped away all the layers of those onions, I realised that I'm just frightened.
I'm really interested in what your relationship with yourself is like, and this sort of ongoing feeling through your life of not feeling seen and not feeling heard and not feeling held by other people. And often when there's a significant wound about that, it also manifests in how we are with ourselves. You've also spoken about that sort of inner critic, sort of judgmental voice towards you. So I'd be interested to sort of hear a bit more, like at this point with, you're at this sort of big transformational point in your life where things that have sort of given you a sense of familiarity and a sense of purpose and a sense of kind of belonging in a sense have been changing. And yeah, I'm just sort of curious as to, as you reflect on it now, like what comes up in terms of, do you feel that you're being kind towards yourself? Do you feel you're being cruel towards yourself? Like what
I do you think? I hate myself. I hate who I am.
How does that manifest in your life? Like what's the, like if I was to be living in your mind and your heart and your body, how would I experience that?
I don't know. I don't really take care of myself. I think this is where I'm really struggling at the moment, because I've just spent 20 years taking care of kids. Mm. And
little tissue, by the way.
I don't think I really know who I am.
That's a really interesting point, though, because you hate yourself, but you don't know who you are. So how do you know who to hate?
I hate the fact that my life has just been dogged. I've sat for the last few weeks, because I've been very on my own for the last few weeks, and I've sat just thinking, I don't think I can do another 20, 30 years. I've worked so hard to try and deal with this like incessant noise.
The impression that I get is that you've really mastered, and I'm sure no one's perfect as a mother, but you've really invested your heart and your energy in being there for your kids and being loving and being attentive. And doesn't mean you've always got it right, but your intention has been to get to get it
150%.
Right. So doing a great job as a parent doesn't mean your children don't struggle. The question is, do your children know that they're loved?
And they definitely know that.
Right. That's all one can do, ultimately, I think, as a parent. One can do their best in other ways, but that's the, as you say, that's the key to the kingdom. Like that's the heart of it. I think what needs to happen at this next chapter of your life is you mastering how to be that loving, attentive, kind figure for yourself.
Well, that's what I've been trying to do, and I just can't.
It has to be important enough, and it has to be the focus that if you think of how challenging it would have been times as a mother, has been at times as a mother, it sounds like you've begun to realize that's what you need at this chapter.
Yeah.
And there's a growing motivation and wish to do that. And you're sat here saying, I think, help, I don't quite know how to do it.
Yeah.
But I think what's important, like for our sort of the beginning of our journey together, is figuring out, you know, there's all, it's like having a map of like 100 different paths we can go down. And I think what's important at this point is we're clear what's the journey that we're going on. And it feels to me that the core of this journey is your relationship with yourself.
Yes, it is. I know that. It is.
And I think the homework that I'd like you to do between now and next time, and I think you're probably already doing this informally, but I think to have a bit more structure around it would be helpful, would be to do, I don't know if you've ever done journaling in the past, or
yeah,
but to take some time each evening to reflect on that day and how you were in relationship to yourself that day. So an example might be that it's tonight, and you know you're sat at home, and you know it doesn't have to be in the evening. You could do it in the morning of the following day, but do it as a sort of daily practice.
Yeah.
That you're sat at home tonight, and you're reflecting back, and you sort of think on your journey home, and then that inner critic voice started saying to you all the things you shouldn't have said to me, or all the things
yeah.
that you did wrong, or all the like. So that would be an example of your relationship to yourself. Another example might be that you wake up tomorrow morning, let's say, and you're feeling a bit sort of tender and delicate, and you say to yourself, just get over it and stop being pathetic for it. So I'm really interested in both the internal dialogue, like the way that your inner critic is speaking to you, but also how you're treating yourself. Like, are you making space for your feelings, or are you shutting them down? Are you allowing yourself to be vulnerable around others, or telling yourself that that's not it? Like, just the way that you're being with yourself, just to take some time each day to reflect a little bit on that. And that will then form a little bit of the foundation for where we kind of continue our journey together with this.
Okay.
How does that sound to you?
Yeah.
And what questions do you have?
Do you want me to write that down, or do you want
yeah,
me to do
write
it?
You can write it, you know, you can hand write it, or you can write it in a computer or phone or whatever.
Yeah.
And you can either send me all of it or send me bits of it. What I'm particularly looking for, I'm doing really two things. One, often just by putting a spotlight on these things, they become more obvious to us.
Yeah.
But also I'm looking for some of the themes and some of the kind of patterns, because often it goes from being I'm not being kind to myself, to really seeing some of the examples of that. And that allows us to be a bit more practical and tangible then in terms of working with it.
Yeah. And that is, you know, I never think I'm good enough with anything I ever do. Mm. So that is something that is a constant dialogue.
Yeah. I want to say as well, the relationship we have with ourselves can change. It's a product of how you were related to and how you've learned to relate to yourself. But the reason I know that can change is you've been very different with your kids than how your parents were with you, and also how you've been with yourself. So I know you have a kind heart. I know you have tenderness and sensitivity and love and generosity. Those things are there. We don't need to cultivate those qualities. We need to change how you're using those qualities and learn to use them towards yourself.
But then that voice is just saying to me, but you've only done that. It's not the real you.
The real you
is nasty, vindictive, horrible.
We'll get into that. That voice has had quite a lot of power up until now.
Yeah.
But just because it's had power up until now doesn't mean it's going to have power going forwards. Any questions or any other questions you've got for me today?
No, that's been great. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks, Katie. Deep breath.
So after my first session today with Alex, I'm feeling quite raw, quite exposed, I suppose, quite vulnerable. It's not a feeling that I particularly like. But I think alongside that, I'm also feeling quite hopeful that maybe I can nail some of these issues. And I'm also quite confident that he managed to sort of get to the nub of the issue quite quickly, which has given me confidence that I'm on the right track. When he sort of pinpointed the fact that I'd, you know, struggled with relationships all my life, really, but the biggest relationship I've struggled with is with myself. That felt good. That felt that he really understood. The idea of having to sit down each day and reflect on how I'm treating myself is an interesting one. And I've done quite a bit of journaling in the past, but it's always been a bit erratic and not very structured, I think. I've just sort of, it's been at moments of crisis or deep emotion where I've just sort of poured out my emotions, but I think this will be a bit more cohesive, and it's something that I'm going to be aware of during the day, and that little voice that's constantly niggling away, trying to bring me down. It's a battle, you know. I view it quite often as a battle, that I'm just constantly fighting this battle to try and. It's almost like it's two steps backwards, one step forward all the time in my life. And that's what I want to try and really, really focus on. So I think it'll be a good exercise for me to do.